Right, thank you. I couldn't have expressed it better myself. I think I can live up to that. Anyway, I lived in Spain in the 70s. I'm quite old. And that was under Franco. And I got to love Spanish art then. And I go back to Spain occasionally whenever I can. Somebody sent me a postcard from Spain and said, you should write a poem about this. This was 5 years ago. And I wrote a poem, and then somebody else sent me a postcard. And I thought fate was trying to tell me something. And in the end, I've written 60 poems on Spanish art and a theme of Spanish. So there are some slides, which Paul is going to go on to the next one. And Velázquez. I'm sure you all know it is my favourite Spanish artist. And these are two paintings from a hunting lodge. The one on the right is Aesop. And the thing about Aesop is that most of Aesop's fables actually weren't written by Aesop, because they were published. They came into being after he died. But what struck me about this particular image of Aesop is just the humanity of the face. I think such a beautifully humane face. So this is the poem I wrote inspired by that. Aesop. That face, you had to invent it. A gaunt arrangement of bone and muscle. Someone who knows the quirks of pride and greed. A man as near anonymous as it's possible to be, lending his vagrant name to others, authoring tales long after he is dead. One hand cups a book, the other slung in his dust-brown coat, the wounded hand of a general or withered hand of a beggar. A jobbing storyteller, a fabled fabulist, with a biography that begins in the slave quarters and ends at the bottom of a cliff. By the threshold of power, leaning slightly back in wry appraisal, in the atrium of a global bank or the hallway of a parliament, he sees the fox and cockerel in us. The other figure there is somebody I knew nothing about, Menippus the Cynic, but in Velázquez's time he was quite a well-known figure from ancient times. And the thing that interested me about him when I read about him is that there are two stories about him. One is that he was a cynic philosopher who was disgusted by materialism, etc. And the other one, that he was a moneylender and a very greedy. So who knows? But I think Velázquez has got more the... He looks like a drunk, actually, with that nose. Anyway, in both stories, he kills himself. One because he's lost all his money, and the other one, well, you'll find the last line I tell you. Menippus the Cynic. Vulture, jackal, shark. Plato's dog. Is this the story we should believe? It ends, like the other, in a noose. Crooked crab-claw finger beckons. Black cloak sweeps us up with the dust into the camaraderie of his nihilism. All he requires is our signature on a high-interest loan and a file of our blood for some necromantic rite. Now he's running a thick and heavy rope through his hands. We hear rage at his losses in the croak as he kicks away the stool. The other tale, well, is incomprehensible. The beggar philosopher, his home the streets, spurning comfort, hanging himself, if he did, out of despair with the human race. I forgot to actually look at the time. I'll try not to read for too long. This is a picture of Juan de Perezo, and that's a picture of Pope Innocent X. Juan de Perezo was actually Velázquez's slave. I think in some ways that's a bit misleading, because Velázquez trained as an artist. He freed him, and he actually had a successful career as a painter. But the interesting thing is, for me anyway, is that Velázquez painted those two portraits with more or less within a week of each other. And I know which one I prefer. So this, rather presumptuously, I've written this in the voice of the slave of Velázquez, talking about Velázquez the painter. He saw things. The water seller, placing a fig in the glass to freshen it. The smiths, hammering out their jealousies in the forge. And he worked them into art that holds good. I, waiting at his side, bound to him by more than legality, learning all the time. A fish scale or a husk of red garlic, shod in the same fraternity of light as a king's trimmings. The white of my square-cut collar, the tear in my sleeve at the elbow, drew him in. He mixed umbers and ochres and painted ancestral sadness into my eye. Juan de Pareja, the mulatto, born in the shade of the Alhambra, outgazing the Inquisitor. The portrait was my pass into freedom. It spoke of my equality. The same week, he began work on Innocent the X in all his severity. This is another image that spoke to me. I think it's actually about a monk who is helping polio boys who suffer from a polio epidemic around the beginning of the 20th century. But because certainly in England we've had the Jimmy Savile and various paedophile scandals, and that's been something in many countries in Europe, I find it impossible to look at this painting without seeing something of that in it. It's probably one of my favourite painters, Sorolla, Joaquin Sorolla, but I just felt that the eye, our eyes are corrupted and we can't really see beyond that image of sexual corruption. Sad inheritance. The black-robed monk with a score of naked boys shepherds them to the sea, his hand on the shoulder of the child on crutches with polio-wasted limbs and hospital-pale flesh. Here is the paradigm of our suspicion. Incapable of belief in his heroic charity, we see sex, we see headlines. The other kids skip through wavelets, but this one halts, as we do, detained by kindly or molesting fingers. The water is painted darker than we would expect for a seaside trip for invalids. The sky is smeared. Nothing clouds the day as much as this cloaked figure and his ambiguous act of benevolence. A mottled wave nears the children in the shallows, the curling white crest, its hollow underside. And this is a painter you all know, Picasso.
Yeah.
Blue period. It's called Celestina. It's based on a 16th century play in which Celestina is a brothel keeper, a madame. And it, again, in the same way as the previous painting, brought contemporary ideas to me. This made me think of trafficking. She has a cataract in my notes. Celestina. She's far from celestial. Celestina, procuress, trafficker, bald. Only half of her sees, but sees with the precision of an accountant. She is absolute. She'll still strip a girl for a client, beat the recalcitrant, calculate exactly all that's owed to her. That's much. There are duchesses and bankers' wives who started a career on one of her mattresses. There are suicides and inmates of state institutions. Memories used to blindside her, not since age slackened her flesh and hardened her mind. Nothing can give back the sight in her eye of pity. Men with skewed vision tell her that she is a mother to her girls. This is a painting by Maruja Mayo, who's a Galician artist. There aren't many women artists in the Spanish tradition up until the 20th century. In fact, I can't think of any. I didn't discover any when I was researching these poems. But in the early 20th century, you get Maruja Mayo, this is not typical of her art, actually. It's certainly a powerful image. And it inspired this story poet, narrative poem. One liked to sleep on the left side of the bed and one on the right. One muffled herself like a Berber bride and one loved to drink the light through her skin. One unnerved you with her silences, one with her confidences. I was the lover of both. One would lie gleaming on top of me like a lion at its prey, and the other lifted no more than a hen in the night to let me in. Twins, without even the difference of a mole, who could swear which was the sphinx in the darkness and which was running bare? Whatever games they played, slipping in and out of each other's identity, ended with a boating accident a mile off the beach. Strong currents, black rocks stripped and battered the one corpse that came to shore, so that I called both her names, cradling her head. The sea did not distinguish. Like them, it revealed and hid. This is a painting I discovered, Angeles, Mary Angeles Santos, and she painted this when she was 19, which I think is incredible. I think it's absolutely a wonderful image, the way that the women are sort of in that rectangle, netted together. She called it La Tertulia. A tertulia is a social or intellectual gathering, and she was painting in the 1920s, and women didn't have these gatherings in the 1920s, it was men who did this. So when she called it La Tertulia, that's a pretty bold thing to do, and I love the way that they're looking out at the painting, breaking conventions, smoking, and just meeting the gaze. La Tertulia. A room with four women. An inner privacy, brewing a mood like inmates of a fever ward, wordlessly synchronized. Light illuminates a cheek, shadows an eye, accents a brow. A bold man with anger, a proofrot would flee rather than bear their favourless scrutiny. skirts taut across thighs, a bare arm, a cigarette. It's 1928 in patriarchal Spain. This is a mutiny. The painting has dovetailed them. Under the chin of the one who observes her own thoughts, another reads, lying on her back. One is upright on a chair, and one reclining completes the square. Lezzies or bitches, witches or ball breakers, they outface the name callers with the power they share. The sad thing about Marie Angelis is that she gave up painting. She had so much talent at 19. And she married another painter and just gave up. It's one of the first paintings I ever saw in Spain when I lived there. Went into the Prado and I saw this. It's the Surrender at Breda, but it's also called the Lancers because of the Lancers. One thing that struck me about it was the man on the left who's looking out at you. Actually, since then I've seen other paintings where there's that effect where somebody in the painting is challenging you. But that was the first time I'd seen it, and I still think it's such a look that he's giving the viewer. I'm here and I don't want to be here, and what is all this thing about war and fighting? So, this poem is called The Lancers. Chess players could not be more decorous in their gestures of affectionate surrender. One swooning in a bow, the other gracefully acknowledging supremacy. These diplomat generals don't see the foot soldier looking out from the ranks of the defeated side, combat smeared, subverting the ceremony with his mocking eye. Meanwhile, in the middle distance, beyond the palings of the lances that fence all in, battle still goes on. Where smoke rises on a road, a weekday market hit by missiles, refugees trek from ruined homes, warplanes shred the sky. The city key passes symbolically from lace-cuffed hand to lace-cuffed hand. Surrender ends the game. The Lancers win. Next one, you all know this, Guernica. Probably you've also heard the story, but when Colin Pyle went to the United Nations to garner support for the Iraq War, they felt that it wouldn't be an appropriate background for him, so they put a blue curtain across it. Guernica. 1937. What 28 fascist warplanes did, strafing the ones that ran, bombing the ones who hid, is imaged in the bull, the horse, the woman and the child, the spiky light, the discontinuous arm, the broken sword. It speaks for London in the Blitz, Dresden raised by fire, My Lai, Fallujah, the office workers in the falling towers. It burns through any veil. It distorts with horror. The twisted face of art looks at the twisted heart of war. An image that gave the title to the book. The book's called The Other Guernica. It's a painting by Luis Quintanilla, who in Spain, for among people who love art anyway, he's known as the painter of The Other Guernica. He also painted images of the Civil War. But they're somehow applicable to all sorts of situations and all times. So there's very much an image of refugees fleeing, very much something that speaks to us. His son lives in America, in California, and he gave me permission to use this on the cover. I find it a very powerful image. It stands for all time. The other Gernica. Another Carthage. Another Magdeburg. It stood in the root of war. The core of the place is gone, bombed to rubble and splinter. Its people flee along the upland donkey tracks. Herod wants to destroy them, and they hardly know why. If they forget their purpose and look back, they will lag and drop to the ground on the journey of the refugee. All his life, Luis Quintanilla has drawn a particular. That cafe waiter, that beggar, even the rats during his prison spell. Now he creates hunger, destruction, soldiers, pain, flight, abstracted emblems for his time and ours. The other Sarajevo, the other Fallujah, the other Aleppo. By Berenguer, who in a way is the father of the political poster. He produced these things going up to the Civil War, in the period before the Civil War and during the Civil War. But he's not only the designer of posters, he was also a politician. He was made Minister of the Arts and Culture during the Republic. And he's the man who commissioned Guernica from Picasso for the Spanish pavilion. And he also saved the Prado collection paintings. He had them moved to Valencia, out of Madrid. Madrid was under attack. So, Berenguer. Boom, kapow, crump, shock and awe explosions in Civil War Madrid. As Franco bombarded, the Republic buckled, but did not break. A caravan of trucks left for Valencia. Velázquez, Goya, and Sorolla hunkered down, hiding. It was a time for simplicity, for posters in red and black. Workers, field laborers, soldiers, intellectuals. A slogan is a clenched fist protruding from rubble. Renau excelled in this, the hammer and sickle, the bayonet, the bandolier. But internationally, he needed other propaganda. Picasso is the man, he decided, for the vacant wall at the World Fair. Boom, kapow, crump, to rescue the Prado and commission Guernica. He fought back with art. I lived in Salamanca. This is a statue of Unamuno, who philosopher and Spanish writer. And he was involved in an incident at the beginning of the Civil War that the fascists came to the University of Salamanca, where he was the chancellor. And they had a meeting there, and they were shouting out their slogan, which was long live death, viva la muerte. And Unamuno could just have sat there and let this happen, but he actually stood up, and you'll hear what he shouted. And he was very old at the time, and he had to be escorted out, actually by Franco's wife, helped him out. But what I like, is the fact that he's there now, his statue is there, and the people in that meeting are not there. The statue of Unamuno in Salamanca. This is the statue. This is the man. What a jut of the jaw, what a stubborn brace of the spine. Not bronze or flesh, but rock. Viva la muerte, the phalangists shouted, echoing their general. Battle hard, with the grit of North Africa still rasping in the creases of his skin. Basques and Catalans, communists and liberals, let them quick spain or die. No business except to preside. Unamuno might have spared himself the jeers. Instead, he shouted from above, Viva la inteligencia! Feebler than the mob, he had to escape on the arm of Franco's wife, his only surety. He stands like rock in the university square. The others now are dust. This is still life, as you can see, and it's by a painter called Juan Sanchez Cortan. One thing about it is that the string there is slightly off centre, so it looks as if the cabbage is actually swaying. It's in the Museum of San Diego. San Diego is on the Rose Canyon Fault, so it's in danger of earthquakes. And it's also right next to Trump's Wall, if Trump's Wall is ever built. Still life. Cellar black. The room behind is absolute night. These five things are all there is. A hanging quince, gibbous. A green cabbage, its tender scalp folded in ribbed leaf. The cantaloupe's open arcs of light. A gnarled cucumber, curving beyond the frame. Someone has carved and eaten. A melon slice remains, ridge-backed with seeds. The cabbage shifts slightly on its twine, leaning from the vertical. Perhaps it responds to some larger movement in the core, here where plates and nations butt together with a history that traces itself from Bonaparte to Trump. The reason it's in San Diego is that Joseph Bonaparte stole it, and somehow it found its way to America. I'll just read one more. Sorolla, the painter who painted the monk with the children. There's an exhibition of Sorolla's works coming to Dublin. We saw it in London at the National Gallery. And he painted, he was known as the painter of the light. And he painted in an area called Cabanyal, which is near Valencia. Cabanyal has, luckily, these beautiful houses with the tiled facades. But the mayor of Valencia had an idea for a kind of triumphal motorway thing that was going to go right through them. But the people, and the fact that the mayor was convicted of corruption, they still exist. The plan never went through. So Rolia himself, long before that, in the 1940s, 50s, he had a stroke in his garden when he was painting. And he did live a few years longer, but he was unable to paint. So this is about various kinds of wrecking. And Sorolla, marvellous painter. Cabanyal. The mayor imagined demolition. Four-lane highways, 20-storey blocks, but locals and a corruption trial saved the tiled facades of Cabañal. Checkered, chevroned, garlanded, green and blue like the colours of Sorolla's seas. Oxen in harness bring the boat to land, its sail bellying. A lean torsoed boy, basket of fish balanced on hip, strides the beach. Children in the shallows let the frilled waves pass over them. Sun and water polish the hooves of a white horse. The fisherman's quarter still stands. For him, he was painting in his garden when the wrecking ball swung through the light.
Folks, we're going to go for a 5-minute break, but big thank you to Derek Sillen for his poetry, and just one big round of applause again.